sure this is recording. Okay, hello. My name is Emily Tinder, and this is an oral history interview with
Aaron Anderson,
recorded on October 30, 2021 at the Northern Michigan University Archives. So to start, where are you from and how long have you been in the UP?
So I was born in Salt Lake City, Utah, but I grew up in California, mostly Southern California. And I was tired of the suburbs, and I was married to a man who grew up downstate near Rochester, Michigan. So he suggested that we move to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and we did in 1990. And we bought a farm in Scandia on Yalma Road.
Great. Have you been here since then?
Oh, no. So living on a farm with the man that was my husband taught me that I did not want to live on a farm. And we got divorced. But I worked for Look Realty as a part-time secretary at that time. So I moved into Marquette, and I lived there for about a year. And then I decided to start a life teaching English in foreign countries. Oh. So I left Marquette in the summer of 1993 and went to the Czech Republic, where I taught English in a high school.
Awesome.
And ever since then, I've come back and forth. I've been to, after the Czech Republic, I came back to this area and I went to NMU and I was in the first Master of Fine Arts program in the English department.
Oh, yeah.
In 2003 was the graduation of that little group. Mm-hmm. I think there were only six of us. So then I went to Kazakhstan in the Peace Corps. Then I came back. There's this question about family ties. I actually talked my retired mother into leaving California and coming up here and buying a house at K.I. Sawyer. So she bought a 4-bedroom house out on base, and my brother was living with her at that time. So that was great because I love this area. This is the only area I like to live in when I'm in the United States. And I had family as I call it a portal. I need a portal to re-enter this culture, either a sofa in a living room or a spare bedroom. I need some place to crash until I can find my feet.
Yeah.
And so that was lovely to have my mom and my brother out at K.I. Sawyer, the 10-minute drive from the airport.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Absolutely perfect.
So for the last, 1993 to now, however many years that was, I've been going and coming back and going and coming back and going and coming back. Mm-hmm. So I worked in, as I said, Kazakhstan. I worked in Ukraine. I worked in Saudi Arabia. I worked in the country of Georgia, and I worked in the country of Armenia. And November 2019, right before the whole world shut down, mm-hmm. I was in the country of Georgia. But something told me, okay, you need to go back to the United States right now. So I came back in November 13th. 2019, and then I've been here ever since, obviously, because I really can't venture out at the moment, right. And I haven't really wanted to. I've really enjoyed reconnecting with people I met, you know, over the years in Marquette, mm-hmm. and it's been lovely. I love this community.
Yeah, you said this is the only place you like to live in the United States, right?
Exactly.
I mean, can you talk a little bit more about why that is?
So I walk in the evenings with a group of women who live here in Marquette, and some of them grew up here, and one of the women has a daughter with a boyfriend, and he doesn't want to live up here. He spent one winter up here with her daughter, and so she's really destined not to see her daughter anymore, you know, as regularly as she would like, because he didn't grow up here. And so everyone was saying, well, you know, if you haven't grown up here, it's just really hard to live here. And I piped up and I said, I didn't grow up here. I love it here. So I don't know if that's just hard to explain. But I like the, I like that we have sort of pseudo-Victorian values.
Okay, interesting.
And what I mean by that is, this is a community that's very small. But until the coronavirus, it had supported a public bus system.
Mm-hmm.
And it supports, you know, the infrastructure. It supports this amazing bike path. I don't have a car. I haven't had one since 1993. And I rode my bike all up that trail, the Iron Ore Heritage Trail,
yeah,
to go to Walmart, to go grocery shopping from downtown. And that is an amazing, that's an amazing structure for this city. The fact that people thought, oh, let's take the time and money and design a pathway for people where there are no cars, and it goes right through the forest. Mm-hmm. So you just look on either side of you, and you're riding through the forest, but you're not bumping over a, you know, a bumpy trail. That's a whole different story, right? The whole trail networks for hiking and everything, and the athletics,
yeah,
and stuff. But the bike path is just amazing. So that's not necessarily pseudo-Victorian. What I mean by pseudo-Victorian is like Kauffman Auditorium and the Marquette Symphony, and that there is like a piano, a group of piano teachers that have their students do recitals at the Women's Federated Clubhouse.
Oh, really?
And then they do recitals. They get together and they you know, exercise their skill. And then just last Friday, I was at the student recitals at the Reynolds Recital Hall. And I was just listening to these amazing people singing opera and playing classical music. And, you know, all the, it takes a certain commitment to valuing the liberal arts to pay all that tuition, to spend all those years working on one's skill.
Yeah.
And that's what I like about this community, is that there are a lot of people who do that. And even just walking through the neighborhoods and looking at all of the flowering plants and rocky little paths and interesting grasses that people have chosen for their little oasis that they've designed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of work, you know. That takes a commitment to creating that oasis, and it's free to anybody walking by looking at the yard.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's what I mean by the people really make the city or the town.
Mm-hmm.
And it's their values and their commitment to those values and the time and money they commit to that. So
yeah, it's a real sense of community here. You know, I grew up in Grand Rapids, and you don't, like, smile and wave to people when you walk past them in Grand Rapids, but, like, everybody in Marquette does that. I feel like that's just indicative of the community.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, are you associated with NMU in any way? You said you were in that master's program. I would love to learn more about that.
Right. So, actually, my first association with NMU, I don't know if you need pedantic details. I'm too pedantic. I like to go chronologically.
That's good for history.
I very first took a class at NMU through Steve Pelto's Look Realty. I was living out in Scandia, and he paid the tuition for me. Here, this is how old I am. He paid the tuition for me to take a computer course at NMU, and it was Lotus 1-2-3.
I don't even know what that is. So
I know, right?
My time.
It was a spreadsheet program to help organize and do bookkeeping for his business.
Mm-hmm.
And this, what's great about this community, so the theme here I want to explore, in addition to doing my pedantic chronology, mm-hmm, is that this is a community that has echoing ties with people. So my teacher at that point was Babette Welch. Mm-hmm. That was her name. I think she's still in the community. So that was way back in 1991 or 1992, right? And then I came back to the community in 2000. And I heard from somebody that there was a part-time job. Oh, I had a friend. I had a friend who was actually signed all the paychecks on campus. And I had met her through a divorce support group right after I'd gotten divorced. And she gave me this part-time job in the comptroller's office. Mm-hmm. So I worked there for about 4 months. And then I found out that there was an ESL job on campus, English as a Second Language job on campus, but it wasn't NMU. It was a very beginning branch of a national private ESL school. Mm. And the program was called University Program. So they liked for foreign students to come and live on a campus, live in a local host family, come into the campus and take ESL classes. So I taught there, and then I also applied to the new MFA program, which started 2000. It lasted for 3 years, so it ended in 2003. Mm. So that's like strengthening my affiliation with the university. And as an MFA graduate student, I was teaching freshman composition classes, just mm-hmm. like a graduate fellow would do with MA classes. Mm-hmm. So then at the end of that, I left the country. And then when I came back in 2007, I was just walking along the campus, and I was at Whitman Hall, and John Mallow was walking through the doorway. He had worked for this ESL, little ESL school. Mm-hmm. It closed, by the way, because of 9/11, because visas were cut off and foreign students didn't have as much access to coming to the United States as they had before. So he said, "Oh, Aaron, I've got a student from Columbia. We've got a little ESL program that NMU took that over." Mm-hmm. And he was in charge of it. He said, "You want to teach her? You can start Monday." Okay. So, you know, you would think it would be crazy to like start a professional life in another country and then come back and expect to find a job or to find a place to live or mm-hmm. to find your friends again. And I never, looking back now, I had no cause to ever worry about that. It always just happened.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, okay. And so that was great. And then let's see. So then I left again, came back, and I came back for 2 years from 2013 to 2015, and at that time Ray Ventry was the head of the English department, so he gave me a job as a assistant adjunct professor, so I taught freshman comp and technical writing in the English department for 2 years there. But I also rented an apartment in one of these converted Victorian houses, which at that time then was three apartments. And it was owned by a man I had met way back in 2000, because I had gone to this little cafe, which was called the Karma Cafe in the basement of the Masonic Hall, run by Denise Nerkola. And I'd met this group of people that met every Saturday at Baby Cakes. And so that's where I met Hal Martin, who is now a retired math professor from NMU. Mm-hmm. And he owned the house and he rented it to me. I was actually renting only a bedroom in a three-bedroom apartment, sharing it with other students and local professionals. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean by this community has these echoes and these people who are mm-hmm. willing to trust and smile and say hi and, you know, let you into their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, did you used to live at 203 Hewitt?
Yeah.
With Bridget and Wilson?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, I moved in there after you.
Oh my God, you're the one that kicked me out.
Yeah. Well, okay, I was under the impression that you left on your own, but.
Oh my goodness, I didn't tell you. how disappointed I was when I said, you don't want to live with me anymore. Oh. And then Bridget explained that she had a friend who had to stay in the dorm because of the mandatory dorm stay.
Yep.
But now she was able to live off campus.
That was me.
This is amazing echo.
Connections. For sure.
I don't know if we were all in a previous life together.
Yeah.
And we're all here working it out, working out our karma. I don't know.
Who knows? Okay, so I just have like a random question, but you were at Northern over like a long period of time where, you know, you left and come back. Do you have any like recollections on the changes that you've seen, you know, from then to now? I'm sure a lot has changed, but anything specific that has stood out to you?
Well, I remember it being more dense and crowded and grittier and cheaper.
Yeah.
Now, it's polished and glossy and sparse and expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I should say any more about that. But you get the, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
All this money on this huge building with all these like nice new furnishings and this classiness. It looks really classy.
Yeah.
And I am a cheap person. That's why I like to rent a room in an apartment with people, right? Mm-hmm. They were so lucky. I was so grateful that they allowed me to sublet because one of the other girls, left before the end of the semester, you know? It's like, who in their right mind is going to let a 59-year-old unemployed woman live in their apartment with them?
You found some good people in Bridget and Wilson, but...
Yeah. So, yeah, they're adorable. But, your question about, like, changes over time. Like, driving into the K.I. Sawyer when it was still an air base and taking that night school with Babette Welch, you know, and learning and, you know, grappling with this spreadsheet and everything. I don't know if the glossiness increases the quality of learning. I don't know if that increases a student's self-esteem or sense of who they're going to become in the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
It's grappling with those problems and learning and creating, writing a paper or doing a project. That's what does it.
Yeah.
So I'm actually, this is rather negative. I was thinking, when I was teaching English during that stint, 2013 to 2015, I later came across one of the students who flunked out right before the end of the semester.
Mm-hmm.
And she explained that she shouldn't have gone to college. She wasn't ready to go to college. That during her high school graduation party, all of her family and friends talked her into applying to NMU. And they had, and they probably still have, what they call the Right to Try program. So what if your grades aren't so great from high school, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have a right to try here. But if that individual had not learned the study habits in secondary school when it was free, really, then the right to try is a trap. It's a right not only to fail, but it's a right to then go $5,000 in debt because right. You didn't finish the first semester.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have anything to show for it. You don't have credits or anything. So to me, the exorbitant, and I think anything is exorbitant because I'm really cheap, but the expenses, it's almost the American professional class cannibalizing its youth. You're nodding.
Yep. I shouldn't interject my own opinion, but as a student, that resonates.
And then when I was in the Peace Corps, fortunately, I didn't have massive school debt. So in the Peace Corps, I was meeting all of these 24, 25, 26-year-olds, and every year I was in the Peace Corps, their debt had risen astronomically.
Mm-hmm.
One woman said she was $100,000 in debt mm-hmm. because she'd gotten a couple of graduate degrees. You know, it's like, holy moly. And then how do you make up for that, and how do you pay for that, and how that must handicap that person mm-hmm. for their life choices. They can't just go off. I mean, you can join the Peace Corps and then get a break in the period in which you have to pay your payments back, right? Mm-hmm. They suspend those payments until you get out and you get a job and everything. But and I don't know all the mechanics of how that's linked to what your salary is or whatever and the mm-hmm. interest on it, but okay.
Well, do you have anything you would like to recollect about the pandemic and how COVID affected and still affects your life?
So the community here really helped me through the pandemic. And this group of ladies that we walk up and down High Street most nights in the evening. And it started with a mining journal suggestion to go out and greet your neighbor and ask how they were doing. Mm-hmm. So these ladies did that. They went outside and they said, "How are you doing?" "I'm fine. How are you?" "Let's go for a walk." And so because it was outside and we wore our masks for a whole year and maintained 6 feet of distance because we are anxious, overly concerned elderly women. But now we don't wear our masks. And it kind of varies because it's such a confusing thing. Like, do you wear your mask? Do you not wear your mask? Do you keep your distance now or not? You're mm-hmm. vaccinated. You have your booster, but still, you know. But the exercise was great. And the checking in with each other was great. Mm-hmm. And developing relationships. And then we still do it. And different people come in and join us, and then they're busy and they don't come back, or maybe it's something we said, I don't know. But and I feel perfectly free to come in or not even go for months and then come back and check in, and it's no big deal, you know. Mm-hmm. And there are so many things going on in this community because I'm eligible for the senior program. I could do Tai Chi every Tuesday and Thursday at 10 o'clock if I wanted to. And yeah. I can go get a meal here and I can go do this here. Oh, and Monday is open mic night at the Marquette Poetry Circle. I'm going to go take a short essay and read that out loud day after tomorrow. So I'm wandering and I'm going off on tangents and I can't even remember what your question was except for pandemic. So the community, this community aspect mm-hmm. of people taking care of each other and making room for each other in their lives. In other cultures where I've lived, which are very, very family oriented because the overarching social structure is so dysfunctional, nobody can rely on it. You have to rely on your immediate family. But then that creates a vicious circle because then people only have time for their family because they're solving each other's family problems all the time and they're giving their resources to their family members. So they don't have any free time. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for a foreigner to actually get into like a family and like have that family time, even if they want to learn English and they want to practice their English, which people will make time for mm-hmm. and have for me in my overseas experience. But here, people will make time for others who aren't their immediate family. And on an from an international perspective, that is really quite rare. So.
Yeah. Do you think there's been any, lasting changes from the pandemic, just in the way that people interact with each other? And in my experience, anyways, like, people are so much less trusting of each other these days and less willing to, you know, be authentic with each other. Have you had that experience or do you think it's changed at all by the pandemic?
Well, I think I have lost a couple of relationships. Not, though, because of the pandemic. One of the ladies in this walking group is really quite anxious about it. I won't tell her about the people I spend time with who are anti-vax, who haven't been vaccinated. But I go with one woman to Big Boy restaurant every week and mm-hmm. have lunch. And that environment, there seems to be no conflict. Everybody just goes in there and eats and they go to the buffet. It's open. and they eat and they're not wearing masks and there's nobody cares, you know. So in that little world, and nobody knows who's vaccinated or who's not vaccinated, and there's elderly people, frail elderly people who go there with their friends and their family and things. So in that space, I don't see any division. With this other couple, the man is anti-vax, and he's actually threatened to quit his job if he's mandated to get a vaccination. Mm-hmm. But I've been in a car with him, and I've gone to the Escanaba State Fair with him, and it's like, that's fine. I just won't get in a car with him again, not because he won't wear a mask or he won't get vaccinated, but because the ding-dong runs red lights. It's like, dude, you know? No, I'll meet you there. I'm not going to get in a car with you anymore. So that's not really, I don't know if that's, it might be coronavirus related if psychologically this whole issue has triggered people's infantile ability of, or infantile response of, no, you're not the boss of me. I'm not going to do what you told me. And maybe that was his reaction to these traffic lights. I don't know, but that went over the line for me. It's like, no, you can breathe on me and kill me with your virus, but you're not going to run through a red light.
Yeah. So a psychological difference, at least, you've noticed.
Yeah, but Marquette, too, I don't know if there are more issues outside of Marquette in the UP with the political divisions. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you have any recollections on that? I mean, this was a pretty turbulent last summer in terms of politics and everything.
Oh, well, there's a guy with a sign right now. I just saw him this week when I went down to the post office. Mm-hmm. And his sign says something like, this isn't political, but 14,000 people died from the vax or something. Mm. And so I didn't confront him or argue with him or ask him kind of like a backhanded criticism. Where did you get your information? You know, it's like, I didn't do that. And when I left the post office, he looked at me and smiled and said, hi, how are you? And I said, I'm great because I'm fully vaccinated. And then he was very, he said, well, God bless you for your choice. And so then I said, well, I do agree with you. It should be a choice. And he said, thank you for that. So, I mean, yeah, when people are in the corner and they're being forced to do things, and you'd think psychologically they'd make the vaccine as rare and precious as possible, and you could only get it by word of mouth, and then everybody would want to get it, you know?
Never considered that. That might have gone over better.
I don't know. Human beings, we're crazy, so who knows.
Well, yeah, I mean, any last thoughts before we head out?
Let's see. Oh, yeah, that was your question about that. Yeah, I think the U.S., just like other countries, did the best they could with the coronavirus response. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mistakes are always made. People are making mistakes. What is it, like 600,000 people in Michigan are now being asked to pay back all of their pandemic unemployment benefits.
Oh, really?
So that's not good.
No.
That's a mistake somebody made, and it's too bad if, you know, somebody struggling has to pay for that mistake. Mm-hmm. We'll see how that gets ironed out, I don't know. But with all of its, I think we're sincere in trying to make things work, you know. So that's what I appreciate.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I guess we're all finished.
Thank you.
Yeah.